From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Music from his film Newt Rockne All-American as Ronald Reagan is being laid to rest under the golden light of a California sunset tonight. The former president and actor has come full circle. It was in Hollywood that Ronald Reagan found his footing. It was in an acting career that spanned two decades that the nation was introduced to a future president. And a future president acquired the tools he later used to charm a nation. Reagan was never a huge star, but he made a good living. He didn't headline great films. He once called himself the Errol Flynn of B-movies. But Hollywood schooled the great communicator. Acting taught him how to sell an idea, to nail an emotion. It polished a persona that drove a political powerhouse. Ronald Reagan, the manly, plain-spoken, sunny, all-American boy from Illinois. Reagan's years in Hollywood also gave him some of his most memorable catchphrases, like this one from his 1940 gridiron classic, Newt Rockne All-American.
Rock. Someday when the team's up against it, breaks are beating the boys. Ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Gipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it. I'll be happy.
Win one for the Gipper. From 1937 to 1964, Ronald Reagan made more than 50 films. Tinseltown transformed him. Never before has a president left behind such a visual public record of his life before politics. Tonight on Point, Ronald Reagan, the actor, his life in film, his years in Hollywood. Joining me now from New York is Stephen Vaughn, professor of journalism and history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and author of Ronald Reagan in Hollywood, Movies and Politics. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Vaughn.
Good evening.
It's great to have you with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, Stephen Vaughn, here we have a president, famously an actor in his early years. You've written in depth about those films and the political backdrop of his time in Hollywood. When you saw President Reagan, the president, could you get Ronald Reagan, the actor, out of your mind? Was it always there behind the political persona?
Well, you know, when I started writing this book in the early 1980s, I had a misconception about Reagan, the actor. I had assumed he was always played a cowboy and was sort of a gunslinger. And when I actually went back and began looking at the movies, and he did about 40 or so that we have at our campus at the University of Wisconsin, I found that he didn't play in any Westerns except a movie called Santa Fe Trail, which came out in 1940. And so I was a little bit puzzled about the disconnect between what the public perception was in the early 80s of Reagan as an actor and what I was seeing when I actually looked at the films.
What did you see on the screen? What was the main film persona of Ronald Reagan?
Well, Reagan came in 1937. He made a large number of films between 37 and 42. I suppose the vast majority of his movies were made in those years. Many of them were what we would call B-movies, or what were known as B-movies, that showed up on the second feature of a double bill, usually at a theater. And very often Reagan would play, I guess as one of the fan magazines put it, Mr. Average on the bright side, a bright, up-and-coming young man, a person who was often associated with the government as a government agent, or perhaps as a lawyer, or someone who was on his way up. A person who really developed a kind of an all-American image, which the studio helped create for him, and which I think probably in some ways was built around his natural personality.
Richard Corliss in Time magazine describes this famous remark in 1966 from Jack Warner, the movie mogul, coming back from a trip to hear that an actor who used to work for him was running for governor of California. He supposedly said, "No, no, Jimmy Stewart for governor, Ronald Reagan for best friend." And Corliss describes Reagan as in the movie world, second lead, second best friend, genial loser. Do you agree with that characterization?
Well, sometimes he was. Oftentimes in the movies he wasn't. But I think what that remark reflected in 1966 was the way in which many people underestimated Reagan. And really, you maybe underestimated his experience in Hollywood. What I found was an environment in a studio, Warner Brothers, which was really very much, very deeply immersed in the politics of the time, of the Depression, of the years leading up to World War II and then into the Cold War. A very politically oriented studio, very politically oriented environment where actors were choosing up sides and oftentimes were polarized over issues. And I really thought that that formed a kind of an apprenticeship for Reagan in politics. Even before he moved into the Screen Actors Guild as president in 1947, he had already an image of a person who was a kind of man of action, a man who was often associated with and seen in military uniform. Of course, in World War II, he didn't leave the country, but he spent most of his time in California working in an Army Air Corps unit that Jack Warner was the commanding officer.
Making propaganda films for the troops.
That's right, and for the Army Air Corps that General Henry Hap Arnold headed. And so, in a sense, it's an image that is, for somebody who's going into politics, I would think, was a very attractive image of the, you know, good citizen, the person who's associated with action, who's associated with being on the side of justice and so forth.
Jack Beatty, we're going to hear a lot from those films tonight. We'll run a lot of film and hear a lot of Ronald Reagan in those years. But before we do, just in this week, where we see such grand theater unfolding in Washington and California with all of the observances of Ronald Reagan's death and funeral, a plain-spoken president who at the same time in all his political life had a deep sense of theater.
He sure did, and I think President Bush put very well his gift as an actor. He said Ronald Reagan played the big, handsome, good guy. He learned his lines and was himself. And that certainly was part of his that naturalness that he had right from the beginning was part of his secret as a politician. He said on leaving the presidency, there have been times in this office when I've wondered how you could do the job if you hadn't been an actor. And he added, because an actor knows two important things, to be honest in what he's doing and to be in touch with the audience. Well, that, if you were to put in a sentence, his political gift, to be honest in what he's doing and to be in touch with the audience, that was Ronald Reagan as politician.
In a nutshell. No kidding.
Yeah, and if I could follow up on Jack's remark there, it strikes me that when you watch Ronald Reagan as an actor, I always had the impression that you are watching Ronald Reagan play a character rather than him kind of slipping into another character the way maybe someone like Laurence Olivier did. And in some respects, I suppose as a movie actor, that's a limitation in terms of your range and what you're capable of doing. Mm-hmm. But on another level, I think probably there is, as Jack suggests, there an essential honestness and people, you know, this idea you get what you see is there even in his movies.
Even in his resistance to being totally absorbed by the part, in the way,
right,
that, as you say, he played the part. I want to dive into the film. We've got so much to hear tonight, and I think it will bring all this to life. Let's hear just a bit from 1939 of Dark Victory. It's one of Ronald Reagan's earliest films. Co-starred Betty Davis, Humphrey Bogart, George Brent. Ronald Reagan played the role of Alec Hamm, a rich socialite who loses Betty Davis to both George Brent and brain cancer. In this early scene in the film, Reagan jokes with Davis about selling a racehorse.
Judy.
Hello, everybody. Judy. Good morning, Alec.
Oh, what a party.
Glad to see you're still on it.
All ready for tonight. All I got to do is change the orchid, see? Good morning, Ann. Nice, sensible Ann.
Good morning, Parasite. Why don't you go to bed before they put you there for good?
Well, now, confidentially, it's a scheme. Your man, Michael, told me he'd give me a nice fat commission if I could get our sweet Carrie to buy your coat challenger.
Michael?
He wouldn't dare.
And I can use the cash, too.
Now, this is the answer. Judy, darling.
Hello,
Carrie.
I will take that coat off your hands if you let me have a bargain.
I won't sell you the horse, but I'll sell you his trainer.
That's who she really wants to buy, but he won't even look at her.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Judith, you want to sell that colt?
No, I do not.
And there in the midst of all that conversation about a horse, that kind of small voice, Stephen Vaughn, of a very young Ronald Reagan, kind of a, I don't know, he wants to sell her a horse, and he's a little bit sneaky sounding.
Yeah, and this is early on in his career when the studio, I think, is still trying to figure out what roles he's going to be the best in, and he plays a sort of a ne'er-do-well or a lush, I suppose, a person who drinks a little too much. And I suppose there was at a time an effort to kind of think of Reagan as maybe another Cary Grant and to kind of mold parts along those lines, but that really was not the major persona that he eventually adopted, and in some ways that movie is a kind of an anomaly for even that early period.
It's certainly not the voice we come to think of later. Remind us how Ronald Reagan ended up in the movies. He was famously calling baseball, calling the Cubs. He went out to Catalina Island for their spring training, winter training, and had a screen test and got an offer.
He had a screen test. I think he left. He didn't think he did it particularly well. I guess he later thought that, well, maybe the fact that he didn't hang around was just what the studio wanted to see. And so he did get an offer to come back and in 1937, and from that point on began making maybe five or six pictures a year. They used to be, as he said, they didn't want them good. They wanted them on Thursday. And many of these B-movies, they would churn out in maybe a week or two at tops. And so that's kind of how he started out.
You can see how a man might develop a certain optimism. He flies to California once, has one screen test, and he's offered a 7-year contract. That's not too bad.
Yeah, and you know, there's a very interesting, at the time he was with a radio station in Des Moines, Iowa, a WHO, and there's a very interesting series of articles that he wrote back from Hollywood for the Des Moines paper, where he talks about his experiences in Hollywood. And it's a fascinating, you know, the sense that, well, here he is in this sort of rags-to-riches world. Very interesting commentary about how when he goes before the cameras, there's this wall of light and there's a sense of privacy that he didn't expect, but they could, from there, could kind of snap into his well-rehearsed lines, as he put it. And it's really where he, I think, begins to learn how to perform in front of cameras.
Let's hear a clip from his 1942 King's Row, Ronald Reagan's favorite film, bar none. He plays the role of Drake McHugh, who co-stars with Ann Sheridan and Robert Cummings. In this scene, he wakes up, famously, from a tragic accident to find that both his legs have been amputated.
Paul Riley, what's the matter, sis?
Drake hasn't got any money. Almost none, anyway.
Money?
Yes, he's just got a few dollars.
Well, he don't need any, does he? Oh, sis.
Randy! 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 Where's the rest of me?
Drake.
Randy!
Yes, Drake.
It was that accident.
Yes, Tim. But don't talk about it yet.
Paris.
Where's the Rest of Me, screams Ronald Reagan in King's Row, a dark film, sexually possessive fathers, insane children, vindictive doctors, the hatred of the rich for the poor. Jane Wyman said in 1948 when she filed for divorce, I just couldn't stand to watch that dismal King's Row one more time. Ronald Reagan loved it. What did he love so much about this one, Stephen Vaughn?
Well, I think he considered that to be maybe his single best acting performance. Now, I think he probably liked the role in Knute Rockne All-American as George Gipp, but maybe as a part better. But he thought this was maybe his best acting role. And in fact, I think the studio agreed with him because in 1940-41, they had kind of elevated him to star status and had given him a nice, very lucrative contract. And he was, in many ways, a kind of up-and-coming young star. This is right on the verge of Pearl Harbor and the United States coming into World War II, and, of course, which interrupted his movie career. The movie, you mentioned, is kind of a dark movie. You're quite right, because the censors had a lot of problems. This was based on a novel by Henry Bellarmine, which was a bestseller. And really, at the center of the story is a kind of an incestuous relationship between a local doctor and his daughter. And, of course, under the old production code, that was not a topic you could deal with. And so they changed it to inherited insanity. And, of course, Reagan's poor character has his legs amputated needlessly by another doctor who's a sadist. And in the movie, he goes on and recovers thanks to the help of Ann Sheridan. In the novel, he dies. His
Stephen
character
Vaughn,
dies.
Hang on. We'll come right back to it. Sure. A dark theme in a week that the nation celebrates a sunny president. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about Ronald Reagan in film, a formative experience of the man who will be president, the man whose death is being observed this week from coast to coast. We're joined tonight by Stephen Vaughn, author of Ronald Reagan in Hollywood, Movies and Politics, and by our own Jack Beatty. And here again, the theme from King's Row, Ronald Reagan's very favorite film. The name of his autobiography comes famously from the film, Where's the Rest of Me? Jack, this dark film, a sadistic doctor, sexual complexity, even a hint of homoeroticism in this film, and yet Reagan takes the name of his autobiography from it.
Yes, and as I remember it, it was one of the few films where he really projected emotion. Often he played a kind of wisecracker, you know, he sort of stood back from the role and quipped and fast talking and so on. But here it was quite raw. It kept coming up, this movie did, and when he became governor of California, he had to make cuts in the mental hospital budget for the mental hospital in the middle of a meeting about that. He said, "Do you know how hard it is to mispronounce psychiatric once you know how to pronounce it right? I had to do it in King's Row, and at first I couldn't do it. It's like deliberately singing a flat note."
Oh, gee. But the lessons that come from there, and they keep coming back, and the phrases that keep coming back, Stephen Vaughn, when you look at Reagan's later political career, he drew again and again, including, and I don't know which film it came from, but the famous line... In the famous debate in New Hampshire when he was down and out and needed to come back against George H.W. Bush, "I paid for this microphone."
State of the Union.
That's right. The thing that is a whole that kind of interests me about this period in Reagan's career is the studio, which itself was very much into Americana and making patriotic films. And I think this was quite true from the moment Reagan came to Hollywood in 37, certainly through World War II and into the post-war period. Mm. And, you know, I think when you begin to think about Reagan's ability to articulate themes in American history, American patriotism, this is very much in keeping with what the Warner Brothers studio was doing in many of its movies throughout the 30s and 40s and afterwards. And so I think that there is a good deal it's kind of a formative period in terms of his own thinking about what America means. And, of course, the movies in so many of our minds come to play a big role in that, I suppose.
A lot of big-name Hollywood actors came back after World War II to reach even greater heights of fame, sort of riding the movies that came after the war. Ronald Reagan did not. His film career went into a kind of quiescence. What happened after the war for Ronald Reagan, Stephen?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of it that he was no longer really the sort of matinee idol. He it seems to me, put on a little weight during the war. He looks a little more middle-aged, really, after the war. There's a certain seriousness about his demeanor. And, of course, the studio then put him into a number of films, Night and Tonight, That Hagen Girl, various movies that did not do very well at the box office. His wife, Jane Wyman, on the other hand, her career just really took off after the war, and she won an Academy Award and in some ways kind of eclipsed him as an actor during the post-war period. But I think it was a combination of his increasing interest in politics, a series of maybe films that were not well suited to him, and simply maybe changes in, you know, physically and otherwise in his personality during that period.
Now, this is at the same time that he became very involved in the Actors Union. What was his role there? How did he first get engaged?
Well, I think he got engaged maybe even before World War II in various ways, but he came onto the Screen Actors Guild, if I recall, around 1946, and then in early 1947, he filled in Robert Montgomery, who had been the president of the Guild, stepped down, and Reagan filled in his term. And then in November of 47, he was elected to a series, I believe, of 5 one-year terms as president of the Guild. And so if you go back and look at the minutes of those meetings, as I have, he really becomes a person who finds his voice in the discussions on those of the executive board of the Screen Actors Guild, and really comes to kind of dominate many of the discussions there by 47 and 48, which I think reflects his own increasing fascination with politics and being interested in politics.
He was born very very left, very hemophiliac liberal, he described himself.
That was his description, yes. And I think that he remained very much a kind of New Deal liberal well into the 40s, campaigned for Harry Truman in 1948, for Helen Gahagan Douglas, who ran against Richard Nixon in 1950. But I think you begin to see around 1947, 48, a person who begins to move away from that New Deal liberalism and turns increasingly in a conservative direction.
We'll look at that and that whole cauldron of course, the House Un-American Affairs Activities Committee and all the rest, the testifying. But let's keep the movies in here. One that we never stopped hearing about during the 1980s was the 1951 Bedtime for Bonzo. I have to admit, apart from the funny name and the idea that there was a monkey in it, I didn't know what it was about at all. Looking back, it's this light comedy, co-stars Diana Lynn and Walter Slezak, and Bonzo, the chimp. Ronald Reagan played Professor Peter Boyd. In this scene, he hits on the idea of using Bonzo, the chimp, to prove that environment rules over genetics when it comes to making a man.
His papa. Hans, you hit it.
What? What did I hit?
Is there any way you could let me keep him for a while?
Keep Bonzo? Where? What for?
At home. I want to see if he'll accept a human environment.
You'll teach him to sleep in a bed, to eat with a spoon, and make patty cakes? What will that prove?
What if I could teach this monkey the difference between right and wrong?
And how will you know he knows? He'll tell you, maybe?
No, Hans. By getting him to do right without hope of reward. To avoid wrong without fear of punishment. Something my father never had a chance to learn. Don't you see, Hans, if it works, Dean Tellinghast will have to admit that environment is all important. That heredity counts for very little.
Yes, but what if the Dean finds out that you're carrying on this experiment right in front of his back?
But he won't. This will be top secret until Bonzo's ready to make his debut.
All right, so he'll have a father. But more things are needed for a good home.
I'll get him for him.
You'll provide maybe a mother?
Yes, I'll provide a mother.
How?
Well, I don't know. But I'll do it.
Ronald Reagan in Bedtime for Bonzo, where he starred with a chimp. We'll talk about the nature-nurture business there, but one thing that strikes me particularly, Stephen Vaughn, in this film is how Ronald Reagan brought that very heartland, middle America tone of voice to the movies, where the hard-boiled New Yorker or the high-blown, high-flown kind of British accent had been much more prevalent. He brought middle America right into the films in his voice.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think by this time, this was, one of the first movies he made after he left Warner Brothers. This may have been a Universal film made by Universal Studios, And you're quite right. That sort of middle America charm is you get that in his voice. And I think Jack may know actually more about this film than I do, but I think Reagan really rued the day that he said that he would never really perform with another animal because he was constantly upstaged. And so he learned a valuable lesson, I think, in that movie.
Well, in choosing a vice president, or I'm not sure where that's
going. Well, I don't know about that. I wasn't trying to draw that parallel.
No. But he did take a lot of ribbing for that over many years.
And I think, the name is, I think, part of the reason why that movie was so much repeated early in Reagan's term.
Yeah. And in fact, he mentioned that. He said, and believe me, Bedtime for Bonzo made more sense than what they were doing in Washington.
Of course, you know, here's the nature versus nurture. What in this film, the young man's father had been a criminal. And so the father of the girl that he was pursuing, who believed this would be passed down to the son, wouldn't let him date or marry the daughter. And so Ronald Reagan picks up a chimp to go out and disprove him. You can't help but look at these films and wonder and try and connect the dots between what later emerged in Reagan's political thinking, Jack.
Yes. You know, someone pointed out this week that Reagan really made a great turn in American conservatism. And you could probably sum it up this way in the terms we're using. There was a great emphasis on just fate. in the old conservatism. Mm-hmm. You know, it was about tradition and the sheer almost genetic compulsions of history, that people did this and they were in Edmund Burke, there are orders of people and society has got to stay very still because if you interrupt the balance, who knows what will happen. Mm-hmm. Fixity, I guess, is the feeling you had about the old conservatism. Well, Reagan changed that to something like a kind of environmental conservatism. Hey, change the world, change the environment. Circumstances are plastic.
Each individual is full of potential.
Yeah, I mean, President Bush today quoted him, Reagan, on America. He called America hopeful, big-hearted, idealistic, and fair. No one would have said that about the old conservatism, even a Barry Goldwater. My gosh, it was just fire and brimstone. Reagan put a sunny face on this. He said anything is possible, and he connected what had been liberalism's stock in trade, the idea that you can remake the environment, that through will and through political effort, you can create a new world. He created that. He connected that with conservatism.
Stephen? Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Jack. I think it's around 1950 that Reagan, of course, begins to do a lot of public speaking, and even before that. But he comes up with a speech called America the Beautiful, in which really he kind of talks about qualities that, you know, he thinks that make America great. And that's about the same time as this film. And so, I think that what your remarks there are right on target.
Stephen Vaughn, give us just a sense of what happened when Ronald Reagan was pulled before the House Un-American Activities Committee as head of the Screen Actors Guild to testify about communist influence in the movie industry. He refused to name names before the committee, but Gary Wills has later written that an FBI file on Reagan later disclosed that he had named people in secret, named presumably people he thought had left-leaning or communist sympathies.
Well, I've looked at that file. To be honest, it's been some years since I did look at it. He may very well have mentioned people on the Screen Actors Guild who, took consistently left-wing positions. Those files are very heavily censored, incidentally, and an awful lot of the names are blacked out, so you really oftentimes don't know who's being talked about. But the hearings themselves came about in October of 1947, and of course, this led to really the first blacklist in Hollywood. It's a so-called Hollywood 10. These were a group of so-called unfriendly witnesses, and Reagan came forward as a friendly witness, as president of the Screen Actors Guild. And by most accounts, in October 47, he did a very good job of articulating the liberal position. At least a lot of the liberal groups were relatively pleased with his position. And in fact, he went back to the Screen Actors Guild mm-hmm. in the weeks after that and tried to get them to pass a motion condemning the techniques or the tactics of the HUAC committee, and failed in doing that. I think he was defeated by maybe a 2-1 margin on the Screen Actors Board. And I think from that point on, he began to recognize that probably to survive here politically in Hollywood, you needed to move yourself maybe away from some of the left, the more left-wing positions. And I see his turn towards the more conservative direction kind of beginning to emerge in that period of late 47, early 48.
He also began to turn away from reliance on the big screen. It wasn't going so very well. Ronald Reagan was one of the first named Hollywood actors to move into television. 1952 offered the role of host of one of General Electric Theater, where he played a very different role on the small screen. Steve Vaughn, did you follow that?
Well, I haven't done as much research on that period as the earlier period, but yes, and in fact, I'm old enough I can remember many of those GE theaters that he emceed and occasionally took part in. And
what was the GE theater? I don't.
Well, it was a kind of a playhouse that the General Electric Company sponsored, mm-hmm. and in fact, Reagan did a good deal of the sometimes of the commercials or ads, if I recall, in between the story. I can think of one in particular where he had a new home which was wired up with modern electrical appliances, which in the 50s was, kind of a state-of-the-art sort of home.
Pretty spiffy, yeah.
Right. And so he, in some ways, this linkage of progress with things like capitalism and electricity and various other, you know, things, I think, is kind of joined up here in this television program. The television, there's no question, that kept Reagan before the American public. And as you say, not all actors in Hollywood wanted to go into TV, but Reagan did. And I think it turned out probably in the long run to be a wise decision, because throughout the 50s, he gave I don't know how many speeches to General Electric employees across the country.
Hundreds of times a year, we read.
Exactly, and in a sense kind of perfecting this speech, I suppose, that many of the themes that he would later articulate.
Already in those speeches talking about the growing government control, wasteful government programs, even in the 50s.
That's right, and I think by the time you get to 1964 and that great speech that he gave for Barry Goldwater, which really projected him on a national audience, he had been, in a sense, practicing those themes for several years. This was not the first time that he had given that speech, I suspect.
Let's hear just a little bit of Ronald Reagan. This is 1956, introducing the GE Theater Hour, here introducing a rebroadcast of James Dean's I'm a Fool.
For General Electric, here is Ronald Reagan.
Good evening. We are pleased to present James Dean and Natalie Wood in a repeat performance of Sherwin Anderson's I'm a Fool, starring Eddie Albert as the narrator on the General Electric Theater.
In research, in engineering, in manufacturing skill, in the values that bring a better, more satisfying life at General Electric, progress is our most important product.
In a moment, in answer to a great many requests, we'll present a film of a fine performance by James Dean in a General Electric Theater play. It was a performance that helped attract nationwide attention to his talent, and we present it as one of the landmarks in his progress toward the great roles of his brief career. Those of us who worked with Jimmy Dean carry an image of his intense struggle for a goal beyond himself. And curiously enough, that's the story of the boy he portrays tonight. Eddie Albert is the narrator, Natalie Wood the girl, in Sherwood Anderson's I'm a Fool.
Ronald Reagan, host of the GE Theater Hour, introducing there Stephen Vaughn, Jimmy Dean, his old buddy, the way he presents it from Hollywood days.
Yes, and there you see Reagan, the kind of master of ceremonies, the kinds of things that he did so very well as president. Honing those skills on television. And indeed, the whole medium of television, which was relatively new. Before Reagan ever goes into politics in 1966 in California, he's got this, this background in both television and radio, not to mention films. And it really, I think, helps to explain a lot why he was seemed so natural in front of the cameras when we saw him on a political stage for the first time.
We're talking tonight about Ronald Reagan on the big screen and there on the small screen. We'll come back and look at how that career slid pretty directly into politics. I'm joined tonight by Stephen Vaughn, author of Ronald Reagan in Hollywood, Movies and Politics, and by our own Jack Beattie. Here's music from Ronald Reagan's 1957 Hellcats of the Navy, in which he co-starred with Nancy Davis, Nancy Reagan later. We'll be back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As Ronald Reagan is laid to rest in California tonight, we are looking back at the career he built in California in films, long before he was involved in politics, and even later as he began to move into politics. Ronald Reagan made more than 50 films and had a career that stretched right on to television. We're joined tonight by Stephen Vaughn, professor of journalism and history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Ronald Reagan in Hollywood, and by our own Jack Beattie. Steve Vaughn, Jack Beattie, I want to go straight to the film in which Ronald Reagan meets Nancy Davis, later to be Nancy Reagan, on screen, Hellcats of the Navy, 1957. Ronald Reagan plays a submarine captain, Casey Abbott. In this film, Reagan makes a decision that kills 60 of his men,
but he remains firm in his belief that he did the greatest good for the greatest number at the same time that he deals with remorse. There's a presidential theme for you. Here we are, 1957, Hellcats of the Navy. In this scene, Nancy Davis professes her hopeless love for Casey Abbott, Ronald Reagan.
What are you going to do after the war, Case?
I've told you 100 times.
I want to hear it once more.
I'm going into the surplus business. I'm going to buy up all the old mines and sell them to the man on the moon.
There's no water on the moon.
How do you know so much about the moon?
I know a lot about it. I spend all my time looking at it when you're away. That's how it still is with me, Case.
Nancy Davis, later Nancy Reagan, and Ronald Reagan in the 1957 Hellcats of the Navy. Steve Vaughn, he did appear before the American public on screen in uniform, giving him some of that veneer of military leader.
Oh, yes, and that goes back to the very beginning of his career. Interestingly enough, Warner Brothers in the late 30s. The Warners were East European Jews who were very disturbed by the rise of fascism and anti-Semitism, and they used their movies frequently to try to bring home a message of military preparedness. Reagan was in some of these films. Some of them, a movie like Brother Rat was a comedy. Others were more serious. International Squadron was a movie in which he was a pilot. And there's a very interesting film, you know, when we were talking about these themes of duty, which he did in World War II, which for the Army Air Corps called For God and Country, where he's a Catholic chaplain. And I believe dies in that, trying to save a comrade. So this idea of sacrifice and patriotic duty and so forth. Those are themes that run right from the very beginning up to 57.
Jack Beatty.
Yeah, you know, and that scene reminds us of the other major Hollywood emphasis in his life, romantic love. He said of Nancy, she was the only person who could make me lonely just by leaving the room.
Wow.
And you can't talk about him without talking about his wife. And their love was a Hollywood kind of, you know, love. Ronnie and Nancy,
yeah.
And some of his love letters showing, you know, just another side to him altogether. I mean, we knew he was avuncular, but here he's affectionate and wooing. And this was so important to him and also important to him politically. She was from a very well-to-do medical family in Chicago. Her father, Royal Davis, was a sort of North Shore, highly conservative surgeon. Mm. And along with the GE emphasis, this really helped to shift his sort of ideological direction. Of course, it had its ironies. Well, he was decrying government to these GE employees. GE was one of the biggest, you know, had more
government
defense contractors than anybody else.
Right,
Never mind. But she had a lot of influence, not just on his, obviously on everything he did, but also on his politics.
This conversation has brought us right up to the moment where Ronald Reagan really begins to move explicitly into politics. 1962, he changes his party registration from Democratic to Republican. And then the famous speech where he stands up at a fundraiser for Barry Goldwater, the kind of doomed Republican presidential candidate. Lou Cannon, Reagan biographer, writes, on October 27th, 1964, a washed-up 53-year-old movie actor named Ronald Reagan made a speech on national television on behalf of a Republican presidential candidate who had no chance to be elected. But it was, by many accounts, one of the highlights of the Goldwater campaign. Within a few months, a group of wealthy Californians form a committee, friends of Ronald Reagan, to initiate his 1966 candidacy for governor. And here comes a star zooming out of Hollywood and straight, Steve Vaughn, into politics.
Well, that's right. Mm-hmm. And that speech, I think, really put Reagan on the political radar of a lot of people, and people began to sit up and take notice that this was a person who was a very formidable speaker, and that he was perhaps a force to be reckoned with, although still an awful lot of people in 1964 and in 1966 still passed him off as simply merely an actor and underestimated him.
And now here we are decades later with another Hollywood actor as governor of California. Jack Beatty, what's your thought? Is this the trend? Are we going to see more people schooled before the camera?
Well, it really helps, it seems to me. I mean, once you pass the threshold of being taken seriously, that's a burden for an actor. It was for Reagan. people used to say, he's just an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But his conviction helped him hurdle that. You know, clearly he meant what he, and that speech shows it, he meant what he said, and that helped him hurdle that role. Yeah, you'd think we'd have more people from Hollywood, since the essence of the president's job now is leading on television.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm struck with is how little attention some politicians pay to that part of the job. And also, it gives a politician familiarity. Reagan was known to millions before he ever entered politics, and they trusted him. They trusted that screen persona, and they transferred it to the man because, as George Bush said, he really played himself.
Steve Vaughn, is it an insult to Ronald Reagan to say that at some level he never stopped being an actor?
No, I don't think so. Probably his role as president was, as Lou Cannon said, a role of a lifetime. And I think many of the things that he learned in Hollywood served him very well when he came to Washington.
And are celebrated even unto this week, the week of his funeral. Funerals right across the country, and this evening his burial. Ronald Reagan in the movie Stephen Vaughn. Terrific to have you tonight. Thanks so much
for joining us.
Thank
you very much.
Stephen Vaughn, author of Ronald Reagan in Hollywood. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me for a look back at the news of the week. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
He believed in America, so he made it his shining city on a hill. He believed in freedom, so he acted on behalf of its values and ideals.
We have lost a great president, a great American, and a great man. And I have lost a dear friend.
He gave us 8 years of his presidency, and we could give him a few minutes of our time and respect.
It's the least I could do to pay tribute to my hero. Did so much for us, did so much for this country, restored our faith in this country.
There are stem cells that are available for research, but also we need to balance the interest in science with moral and ethical issues.
The nations of the G8 are committed to the success of Iraq's government, to the defeat of its enemies, and to the future of Iraq as a free and democratic state.
Any interference by NATO in this region seems to us will carry many risks.
The Kurdish parties are now warning they might bolt the new government if the Shiite majority gains too much power here.
Those are three memoranda. Will you provide those to the committee?
No, I will not.
On what basis? Under what basis?
On the basis that the long-standing, established reasons for providing opinions provided to the executive branch.
General, the executive privilege is not a legitimate basis of withholding memoranda from this committee.
Georgia. Georgia.
I've been very blessed in my career that people have loved what I do and have accepted me. The audience is number one, my peers number two. But when you look at it, it's a nice thing to be accepted when people know what you're doing and they know what it takes to do what you do.
I said in Georgia.
And there's a week. Former President George Bush, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and hundreds of thousands of others pay their last respects to former President Ronald Reagan, who died on Saturday at age 93. Even in the wake of Reagan's death from Alzheimer's, or with Alzheimer's involved, First Lady Laura Bush indicates her husband won't budge on the issue of stem cell research. At the G8 summit in Sea Island, Georgia, President Bush asserts that the major industrialized nations are committed to helping democracy take root in Iraq. Speaking through a translator, French President Jacques Chirac says he opposes NATO taking a role in Iraq. A power struggle in Iraq as Kurdish leaders threaten to withdraw from Iraq's new government. Attorney General John Ashcroft refuses to turn over to lawmakers administration memoranda that outline the degree of pain and suffering to be permitted during enemy interrogations. And music legend Ray Charles dies of liver disease at age 73. Jack, there it is, and it's been a big week for Ronald Reagan, back in death.
back in death and with soaring rhetoric in today's service about him, really quite extraordinary tributes to him, heartfelt, moving. Margaret Thatcher said he freed the slaves of communism. He's the Lincoln of our day.
Brought back the evil empire phrase in her remarks.
Absolutely. And Mr. Gorbachev had to had that wall torn down for him about 10 times
ouch,
in the course of the thing.
Right.
And President Bush, in one of the best speeches of his presidency, warm and funny and phrased with precision. It makes me think maybe Peggy Noonan, Reagan's speechwriter, had something to do with it. He said of Reagan, he's been dead only a week, but we've been missing him for years. And then said, talking about being elected in 1980, the convictions that shaped the president began to shape the times. And there's no question about that. Those convictions shaped his times.
No question. I was struck in the remarks today by those made by Sandra Day O'Connor. There's been so much quoting this week of President Reagan's frequent use of the city on the hill metaphor for the United States. Sandra Day O'Connor, in her inimitable way, putting that in a context which is very illuminating, quoting the source of that phrase from John Winthrop in 1630 as he came coming ashore, America then, the unsettled continent on the ship Arabella, and the sermon. Let me just quote from what she was reading there. It puts a different perspective on things. She quoted John Winthrop at length, saying, "We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work as members of the same body. So shall we keep the unity of the spirit in the bond of peace." And then, of course, going on to say, "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill." But with all the preamble that gives John Winthrop's context for that, which is a very socially minded, community minded preamble indeed, that Sandra
sounds like Franklin Roosevelt sitting on the hill.
It does practically. I don't recall Ronald Reagan using that part of it too often, nor the eulogies this week.
Right. In his version, it seemed to be, we're a great country and we stand for ideals, but it was a sort of kind of an every man for himself American dream that he had. We'd all pretty much have a good living and think about ourselves and look up to the country
and be all that we can be.
Be all that we can be, but
each one of us.
Each one of us. It didn't have this. You're right. That was. I was struck by the same thing, that this was a context under that speech that was under the Winthrop speech that was really, say, sort of casting a light on the limits of Reaganism, all that he achieved, but all that he didn't achieve, and he didn't move in that direction. That wasn't the direction he wanted to take America. Indeed, he wanted to take it somewhat away from that communal sharing abridging ourselves of our superfluities. Heck, hold on to your superfluities.
Right.
That was Reagan's idea.
Accumulate. Life is how many superfluities you can collect, right? But that very much the theme of the week in Sandra Day O'Connor standing in some opposition. A slow-burning fuse under this entire week that may not burn so slowly forever, Jack, in these comments by Attorney General John Ashcroft, not willing to turn over memoranda to Congress. Of course, they're practically public. But the issue of responsibility for what happened at Abu Ghraib, not a finished subject, and a kind of constitutional crisis still brewing in the background here that we will not take our eye off of in the weeks ahead.
Yes, and with its own echo of Ronald Reagan. Mr. Bush said, "I didn't authorize, what I've authorized is that we stay within the U.S. law." Well, Ronald Reagan said something like that about Iran-Contra. He says, "I didn't authorize arms for hostages deal."
What, who, me?
Yeah, right. I'm enjoying my superfluities.
Right, and there it was. Well, a goodbye to Ronald Reagan with this week, and a grand goodbye at that. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.